It's a daunting mission to go boldly where many have gone before, to take this...
Scotty, I need warp speed in 3 minutes or we're all dead.
To this...
Hi, I'm like a Clabnin fire tea. 3 Budweiser Classics, 2 Cardassian Sunrises, and...
Try the slush show, it's good.
The slush show mix, thank you.
The man who accepted this mission is director J.J. Abrams. He has a record of putting the chic in geek in a number of sci-fi flavored character-driven pieces you might have heard of, Lost, and now he's taken the Federation back to hipness and to number one at the box office. He joins us in a moment. We will stipulate to Mr. Abrams that you really did like the picture and admire his work greatly. If you have a real question about Star Wars or his TV programs, give us a call, 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org. And you can join the conversation at our website. That's at npr.org. Click on Talk of the Nation. J.J. Abrams joins us now from his office in Los Angeles. Welcome and congratulations.
Thank you very much. How you doing?
Very well, thanks. I wonder, a week ago today, before Star Trek pulled in more than $75 million over the weekend box office, were you nervous?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I've been sort of, you know, you're nervous the whole time working on a movie, but especially something that has a pre-existing fan base like Star Trek.
Because people are going to hold you to what their idea of all this should be.
Exactly. And the fact is that I was not a Star Trek fan when I began working on the movie. I've, of course, become one. But at the beginning, I didn't really have that sense of it being a sacred text or anything. But I just knew there was a large contingent that did.
I thought the director of the new film had to pass one of those tests like we saw in Diner for the Baltimore Colts.
I think that was what I thought would happen as well, but I was involved as a producer, and I knew that one of the goals that I had was to try and help be involved in a film that would appeal to non-Trek fans, a film just for moviegoers. And when I finally read the script that was written, I loved it, and I realized perhaps if I want non-Trek fans to go to the movie, a non-Trek fan should direct it.
And those guys, though, the screenwriters you're talking about, they were Star Trek fans.
Exactly. I mean, Alex Kurtzman and Roberto Orci wrote an amazing script, and they are very savvy, wonderful writers who were aware of two things. One, we had to please the fans of Star Trek. They're a very vocal group. And secondly, we had to make the movie more of a priority was to make the movie for mainstream audience, not just a Trek fan.
I want to play a little clip from the movie. At the heart of the story is a guy, James Tiberius Kirk, with serious daddy issues.
Enlist in Starfleet.
You guys must be way down on your recruiting quota for the month.
Now, if you're half the man your father was, Jim, Starfleet could use you. You can be an officer in 4 years. You can have your own ship in 8. You understand what the Federation is, don't you? It's important. It's a peacekeeping and humanitarian armada.
We done?
I'm done.
At its heart, it seems, and I know you've spoken about this, I've read interviews you've done, you seem to have portrayed this as a picture about a family.
I think it was important that the approach to Star Trek not be the same as it had been, meaning there was this assumption that you knew and understood and cared about the characters. But for me personally, there was never the way in. I didn't know James Kirk before he was a captain or Mr. Spock before he was a first officer. I sort of didn't. I felt like I missed the episode where I was allowed in. And this movie was very much meant to humanize and sort of, in a way, bring back to Earth the characters and their humanity, and then send them off on an amazing adventure.
A wagon train to the stars, it's the way Gene Roddenberry first described it.
That's right.
Regrettably, I'm old enough to remember wagon train. Ward Bond was the captain of that particular five-year mission. Anyway, as you look at this story, effectively, all of your projects. If you look at the people on the island in Lost and the group of researchers in Fringe, this all seems to be about this idea of a ad hoc family.
Well, I do think that, you know, whether it's a television show and a long-running, you know, one at that, or a two-hour film, you're always looking for the, you know, every film, every story, TV show needs the main character, needs the way in, and I think that it's often an allegory, a metaphor for something that is very relatable. to our own lives. And obviously, family, whether it's literal family relations or friends or coworkers or what have you, everyone's looking for that paradigm, that dynamic, and that's why you have, you know, archetypical characters. And Gene Roddenberry did a brilliant job at creating this world where you have these different figures that are relatable to our own lives. Of course, friends of mine who are huge Star Trek fans saw that years and years ago, and it just took me a long time to catch up.
We're talking with J.J. Abrams, the director of the runaway box office hit Star Trek. 800-989-8255. Email us talk at npr.org. Joe's with us calling from Providence, Rhode Island.
Hi there. Really quick geeky question for you. Was there an intentional correlation between the way that Scotty was discovered in the new movie and the way that we've learned about Desmond in The Hatch? I'll take my question off air.
And that's a Lost reference.
Correct.
Okay.
It is. Yeah, there was no, you know, purposeful connection there. Clearly there are, you know, aesthetic similarities, and given the fact that both Star Trek and Lost were produced by Damon Lindelof, who runs the show Lost, and he and I created that series together, I'm sure that there are things that interest us. There are, you know, stories and conventions of storytelling that will probably make for similarities, but it was never an intentional one, though.
Here's a tweet from Twitter user Magdalene Bloom, who writes, "Absolutely love the new Star Trek movie. I've been a Trekkie since the original series, but what was with that cliff in Iowa?"
Well, it's funny. If you look, it's a quarry. So instead of it being a literal cliff, it was a hole. that sort of explains the ridiculous situation there.
I thought part of the Grand Canyon had just migrated a little bit.
Exactly. Well, in the future, there's a big need for whatever the rock that they were digging there. So.
Let's get Brian on the line. Brian calling from Roanoke, Virginia.
Hi, Mr. Abrams. I'm a huge fan. I first got into Fringe last fall after the third episode, and I absolutely love the new Star Trek. Something that I have noticed in your works is that you seem to really love puzzles, just clues and stuff like Rubik's cubes that you like to throw in for your audience. I especially admire the glyphs that are on during the Fringe commercial breaks. What inspired your love of puzzles?
Well, thank you for your comments and enthusiasm. The truth is that you know, while I enjoy puzzles, what I enjoy more is sort of, you know, the idea of compelling ideas and stories that require the audience to fill in the blanks. It's not puzzles per se, but it's the idea that a story presents a question that you may not even be aware that you're interested in, but there's something about, you know, a story that asks the question. It can be as simple as in Star Trek, for example, when we meet young Kirk, we know he's going to be captain, but he's hardly a captain at the beginning. So it could be as simple as that. How is he going to earn that captain's chair? What's that adventure going to be? It can be more specific, which is how are they going to kill the shark in Jaws? It could be whatever it is, you know, an overt mystery, a whodunit. I just love stories that force the audience to lean forward and to kind of look into the screen to try and figure it out. So that's, to me, my approach. Puzzles are sort of a more literal way of you know, equating that to, you know, everyday life. But in stories, that's my favorite thing.
Brian?
I think it's brilliant how in Fringe you have clues as to what the next episode is about in every episode that you never noticed on the first airing. And
exactly.
The whole thing with the Observer just floored me.
Oh, right on. Well, thank you so much for that.
And Brian, thanks very much for the call.
Okay, you're welcome.
Bye-bye. Here's an email from Michael in Mooresville, North Carolina. I wonder what was the most difficult aspect of the reimagining character and or the Star Trek world, and what part of the relaunch did you find the most creatively satisfying?
Well, thank you for the question. I think that it was so much fun to do this movie. The cast was incredible. They're this great group of young actors, and they were just wonderful and incredibly hardworking and terrific to work with.
And for this film, cheap.
Well, people say, oh, they're never going to be this nice again.
They'll never be that cheap again.
That's right. Well, I got to say, the cheap thing, you might be right, but in terms of the kindness, their work ethic, they're wonderful people. So I'm rest assured they're going to be, you know, they're going to continue to be sweethearts. But in terms of the most challenging, I think that the idea was to take something that is as clearly overtly sci-fi and fantasy as Star Trek and make it feel real. That's not to say that we're supposed to believe it's actually happening, but I wanted to try and make it feel tangible and believable. And so every aspect of what was created now almost 50 years ago needed to be filtered through that context. What makes it relevant? What makes it real? What makes it vital for now? And so whether it was the acting, the casting, the writing, the prop design, the production design, the visual effects, any of that, it was really all about trying to legitimize it. And one other thing is balance the crazy, huge, epic sort of spectacle that the script required and also the intimacy and the emotion of the characters. Because if you don't care about the people, if you don't love those characters, none of the visual effects are going to matter.
We're talking with J.J. Abrams, a co-creator of Lost, Fringe, and other TV shows, producer and director also of Star Trek. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's see if we can get Peter on. Peter's calling from Syracuse.
Yes. Hello, Mr. Abrams. I have a quick question for you. I was a big fan of the movie Cloverfield, and I couldn't help but be slapped in the face by the, or sort of just really astounded by the echoes to 9/11. And, you know, hearing that line on the air, the peacekeeping armada, I'm curious, you know, this being a, you know, futuristic story, that it, whether you have a preoccupation with the political or with current affairs in your films.
Well, I think that first of all, I'm glad you like Cloverfield. The thing that is interesting to me about any kind of science fiction, fantasy, or horror is that usually those genres are potent because they are in some ways a reflection, allegory of what's actually happening. My favorite show of all time was The Twilight Zone, and one of the things that Rod Serling did so brilliantly is take issues that mattered to him, politics, race, you know, important social issues, and he got into such trouble with the networks and the sponsors that he finally decided to turn, you know, his attention to science fiction, which would allow him to tell the stories he cared about safely. While we didn't overtly try and make, you know, Star Trek into some kind of, you know, political treatise, we wanted to make sure that we were telling a story that felt relevant and valid. And so, yes, there's clearly you know, issues that I think there are clearly issues you could draw parallels to. But the most important thing about Star Trek for me is it's an optimistic story. It's a world that is, you know, it's our future, and it shows collaboration across political, racial, cultural lines, even interspecies. But the collaboration is what will save us, and that to me is a wonderful message and very refreshing after many, many years of dark, post-apocalyptic, cynical futures on film.
Peter, thanks.
Yeah, thank you. And just really quickly, I was a huge Star Wars fan up to this point, and I was very disappointed by those three movies, but Star Trek has sort of brought me back to being excited about a space movie again, so thank you.
Oh, right on. That's very nice of you. Thank you so much.
Here's an email from Sarah in Columbus. I'm 24 years old, and one aspect of the old Star Trek I always thought really dated it horribly was the gender roles. Hundreds of years in the future, the only woman with authority on board is, of course, in a miniskirt. How did Mr. Abrams and the movie team address gender and race roles?
Well, I think that, you know, first of all, the character Uhura, played by Zoe Saldana, who I think is just a brilliant actress, is critical to the story. It, you know, is a very strong character, is obviously wildly opinionated, and she's got a role like every other person on the show and in the film. Without that person, they would not have survived, and they wouldn't be there together as a family at the end. In terms of what we inherited from the original series were these characters. Our film is a complete sort of new take. At the same time, especially with Leonard Nimoy continuing the role of Spock, it's a continuum. So we couldn't really shift everything and change the dynamic. In fact, that was one of our, like I said earlier, one of our responsibilities was to be sort of true to what came before. But as someone who, whether it's, you know, the lead character in Alias, the lead female character in Fringe, the character of Kate on Lost, you know, I have been, or Felicity, I've been lucky to be involved in shows that have had very strong characters who happen to be female, as well as male. And that's very important to me. And I certainly don't think that, you know, that women will or should be at all insulted by the depiction of this woman, Uhura, in the movie. I think she's an incredibly strong character.
And let's get one last question in. This is Caroline. Caroline with us from Woodstock in Virginia.
Hi. I was curious if there was any talk about a sequel to this movie, because some of the aspects of it are not accurate, like Spock's mother dies. I mean, she's not dead in Star Trek. So I wondered if there was any talk of now another one.
I think, Caroline, you're the first one to mention it.
I think the fun of this movie for me was, on the one hand, it's an origin story, but on the other hand, it separates from the existing timeline to create essentially its own timeline. So in the timeline of this film, Spock's mother, in fact, does die, which is a huge spoiler for those who have not seen the film. But the movie itself acknowledges, in a way, the timeline of the TV series. So for those fans who love the TV series, we are not denying it. We're not, you know, revising it. We are admitting that that coexists. So in this timeline, we have our own instances, our own story, our own, you know, results, which allow us to make a prequel that doesn't have that problem that most prequels have, which is, oh, I know how it turns out because I've seen
right.
the other ones.
Hmm.
But I will say that we have not had one discussion yet about what a sequel would be. There's a deal with the writers, there's a deal with the actors, but we have yet to have one meeting. We wanted to sort of see if people would like the first one before we started working on another one.
Caroline, thanks very much. And J.J. Abrams, thank you so much for your time. And good luck with that new picture, whatever it is.
Thank you so much. Very kind of you.
J.J. Abrams, director of Star Trek, already at a theater near you. Tomorrow, Mike Pesca hosts Science Friday. He'll look at the search engine that may have what Google wants. That's tomorrow's Talk of the Nation, Science Friday. I'm Neil Conan, NPR News in Washington.